Now it's my pleasure to introduce Steve from Sydney, who got up at 4 a.m. to share with us, and we are so delighted. Thank you so much, Steve. And he'll be talking on, I believe, the second part of Bill's story, starting, I believe, on page 8 at the bottom or top of 9. Is that correct?
Bottom of 14, actually.
14, okay. Sounds good. All right, thank you. So, yeah, go ahead, Steve. You've got 20 minutes. Would you like a 5-minute warning?
Yes, please. That'll be great.
Great.
Thank you.
Caroline, are you okay with a 5-minute warning and then 20 minutes to share total?
Good, I'll do that thing.
Thank you. Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you so much, Judith. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Sydney, Australia. And it's an absolute pleasure and honor to be here with you all. Thank you so much, my friend Carol, for asking me to share. Really appreciate Carol. She shared with us probably a couple of months ago at our Sydney BBA meeting. And I've heard Carol prior to that a couple of times, actually, in person, on Zoom, that is, in the US. But prior to that, several years back, I would say probably a good... good 5 years ago on the, I think they were the Monday night phone meeting recordings with Dan Sherman and our friend Lynn and Kimberly and Tyler, of course, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with. And those recordings were very graciously put online on the BBA webs, BBA Works website. Couldn't have come at a better time for me to listen to all those people, including Carol, who, you know, as I went through the BBA for the first time in Sydney for my problem, which is alcoholism, that was probably around early 2013. And those recordings were so helpful, and Carol's voice was very calming on the phone and very obviously... with deep knowledge around the process. So, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that and just say thank you to Carol for that. And obviously our dear departed friend, Dan Sherman, who I'm sure is watching over all of us with a big smile on his face and very proud of how far-reaching a simple message has gone. You know, obviously for all of us, I'm speaking to one of your friends here from across the pond in the UK, and it's nice to visit the UK, although it's virtually. Nice to visit there again. My last visit to the UK was in alcoholic fashion, I'll say that. I went there initially, when was it? 2008 for the first time. It was my first overseas trip. And maybe I can tie that in with the start of Bill's story a little bit. You know, I think Bill was a young man embarking on the First World War and you know, he felt like he was a part of life at last. And I think that's what it was for a great many young men in the US and worldwide. You know, if you get to travel for free, right, going overseas, but you're going into a war, you know, and I guess for me, I was happy to get out of this. It was more of an escape plan for me when I went overseas. I went to the UK first, and my drinking was obviously well out of control before that. But you know, I did a lot of drinking in the UK. There was a lot of and I can't say it was all bad. You know, like the start of Bill's story. You know, I had fun. You know, I did have fun initially. And, you know, it was a funny experience. I went there with two friends, good mates, and we started off in London and then went over to Scotland. And for the first couple of days, we stayed at a couple of, a lot of pubs there have accommodation above and such. I'm sure you guys are very familiar with that. And, I remember one morning I stumbled downstairs early and I was obviously still drunk, and I came to the front to have a cigarette, and a postman pulled up and, you know, got like I just felt so terrible when I got to Scotland, and it was in Glasgow, so it was speaking very thick Glaswegian, and I couldn't understand a word them were saying. And the whole time I was there for about 2 weeks, I apologized probably for the first 3 days, and I was like, just stop apologizing, don't worry, if you don't understand what we're saying, just shake your head. And and this postman pulled up, and it was very nice, and I was so struck with how lovely people were. Now obviously some major cities are a bit more hustle and bustle, like Sydney here, and you know, but I think when you get to the smaller towns or regional parts, people tend to have a little more time. And I was so struck by this postman. He kind of pulled up and he's like, "Oh, hello, hey, how you going? Where are you from?" "Australia, Sydney." "Oh, that's great." And I think it was nearing midday, and the guy actually, you know, just pulled up, had a cigarette with me. You know, he's like, "You know, if I had time, I'd have a pint with you." You know, and it's just lovely, you know. And God, if my drinking stayed like that, you know, just meeting people and visiting the world and just doing nice stuff like that, I wouldn't be here, to be honest. You know, BBA has given me an amazing quality of life, and so has sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't forget that. Like, we are all still members of our respective fellowships. And I think the importance of that is to, although BBA is amazing, not to neglect, you know, that our roots, you know. And that's given me I love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I love BBA and the community that sprouted out of this. You know, I wouldn't typically go to meetings where, you know, I speak to people with a variety of other addictions, you know, other compulsions. You know, I'd be speaking exclusively to alcoholics, you know, and it's opened my mind to hear people with other issues, and to see that we're not all that dissimilar, you know. So that's been a good thing. But yeah, getting back to what this has given me and who I was, and that trip to the UK. And the reason why I bring it up is because really that's where it all properly began to fall apart for me, you know. And leading up to the topic today, in line with Bill's story, that's what we're doing in Bill's story. We're trying to find our story. And I wasn't in touch with my story. You know, one would think you go through your drinking or your drug addiction, and because you walk into whichever fellowship you walk into, whatever your compulsion is, that you would clearly be able to see your past and understand, you know, the horror that qualifies you for walking into the rooms, you know. And obviously it's more than that. It's obviously more than all the terrible things that happened that finally shook me into an awareness that I have a serious problem with alcohol. But I was blind to the symptoms. I did intuitively feel there was something physically wrong with me, but I didn't understand that it was a craving. I did concede to the fact of having mental health issues. I didn't understand that that was attached to an obsession, and I certainly had no idea that underneath it all is a spiritual condition. Nothing. I just went through life drinking, feeling that it medicated how I felt, and I began to fall apart. You know, I fell apart emotionally years earlier, growing up in an alcoholic home. For those of you who are Al-Anon, I relate, I identify deeply. My father was the alcoholic. That's my earliest memories, you know. My father falling over himself, arguments in the home, dad drinking around the clock. God knows how he went to work. Violence in the home, not all the time, but enough to hurt a young child and to be scarred from it. And eventually my dad's drinking ended up costing him his life when he was 69 years old. I was 24. I'd been drinking since I was around 16, and I thought I drank because of him, you know. And when he went, I felt a tremendous amount of guilt around withholding a lot of love from my father. And obviously he wasn't the cause of my drinking while he was drinking, and his death really wasn't the cause of my drinking, but it sure felt like it. And from 24 onward till I was about 28 and went overseas for the first time, I was trying everything possible to run away from myself and my life that I had put together in that time. I had a girlfriend of 4 years. She was pressuring me for marriage, and she was a great girl, and we would have had a great life. I'm getting married. I was meant to be getting married in 2 months to my partner, who's also in recovery, but we've had to push the wedding because we've had Delta. COVID has gotten a bit out of hand here in Sydney. Nothing to the scale of what you guys have been through, so I'm not going to dare make that comparison. But it's enough to jolt us here in Sydney, and we pushed our wedding, you know, to next year. But it'll be okay. It'll be amazing when we get there. But this girl that I'd promised marriage to years earlier, you know, part of me going to the UK was, and I won't say her name. This is how I phrase it to her. I obviously need to make peace with my past, what happened to my father. So I'm just going to go to Croatia, which is my heritage. My parents were both Croatian. I don't speak it very fluently, but I get by. So I'm saying to my ex-partner that, look, I'm going to go there. She's very understanding. I get it. I know how much that hurt you, and you need to make peace with that. I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to this little home, our hometown, this little village in Croatia, Drniš. In Dalmatia, and I'm going to make peace with that. And while I'm there, I'm just going to go with a couple of friends. I'm going to go via the UK first, just because I'm in Europe. I'm going to have a look around. But I'm going to do a Kentucky tour. And for those of you who don't know, that is a 28-day bus tour. It is basically a pub tour across Europe, around 12 countries. And by the time I landed in Croatia, I had a huge fight with my friends in a rental car. Both of them just got out of the car, escaped. You're a lunatic. You have problems with alcohol and drugs. Screw you. We're going to Italy. We don't want to see you again. And that was about a month into a three-month trip. And I was on my own, and it all fell apart. And I shacked up with a girl that I had met on the tour, and my partner back home found out what I had done. I became very quickly aware of what Facebook was. Had no idea what that was, and some photos appeared online, and that relationship was over. And I fell apart properly, worse than I ever had in the UK, and. That girl went, and I came home, and I kept going for another couple of years. Met another girl, trashed that relationship. And the crescendo moment for me was going into a local bar that I'd been to a lot of times, seeing that ex-partner, the one that I had cheated on overseas, and her friends and sisters were there and wondering why I was in her local bar where they like to hang out and dance. And one of her friends picked up a bottle, hurled it my way. I ducked, pulled my head out of the way. It smashed behind me. And I'd realized, you know, that I'd not only been going through life trashing my own hopes and dreams with drinking, I'd been trashing other people's, you know, That's what it had come to. And a few months after that, I'd been savagely assaulted in a bar fight that I provoked, you know, and that was it. Should have gone to rehab, should have gone to get some help, and I did not. I ignored friends who encouraged that, and I had my head split open, my teeth were chipped, my pride was absolutely broken. Bill says at one part in his story, I stepped out of hospital a broken man. That night when I got my head stitched open, when I provoked this bar fight, the nurse doing it said, I've run out of anesthetic. I just need to go to another ward and get some. And I thought, I said, love, I've been anesthetizing my whole life. And tonight,
5 more minutes, please.
Thank you. And I said, I don't need it. You know, and she stitched up a scar about an inch and a half long with no anesthetic while I was just broken, you know. So I know I've stretched out this lead up to the topic, and I did that because I don't really believe that any of these steps will apply, or the sincerity in which I need to approach recovery, whatever avenue I come into it at, whatever fellowship, until I'm sufficiently broken. I don't think you get adequately broken in the fellowship. There has to be some part of you that just cracks in order to be receptive. And by the time I'd walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, January 1st, I'm kidding, it was 30 days later. I wish it was January 1st. My partner is January 1st. But in my mind, I was getting sober on January 1st. And then 30 days later, I stumbled into a meeting on the 30th of January, 2012. And I related. And I progressively became more open-minded as time went on. And thankfully, when I broke down sober with all that emotional stuff that was unresolved, a person put his hand out and offered to help me, Mark. And Mark waited until I was ready for BBA. And I think that may be a different thing when you're ready to come into a fellowship and be supported versus when you're ready to go through a formal process and wake up to really what's going on. And obviously, as we all know, you turn statements into questions. But eventually, as I moved through this process and started to learn how I was sick, much like the second half of Bill's story with those proposals there about what he had done and what Abby introduced him to, what would be involved, eventually it started to dawn on Bill that this could be really helpful for me to do for others. This could be really helpful for me to help other people. And the paragraph that I had chosen was, my friend, Ebby, had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. I need to do more than share well and be a good guy while the audio's recording and while I'm at a meeting on my best behavior, right? I need to live this way when I come home. I can't speak spirituality, come home, kick the dog, be a terrible partner, be a horrible son to my mum. Right, I need to live this way of life everywhere. Okay, spiritual life isn't a theory. I'm not the best example of this thing, but God, I know that I have to live it. I have to. It goes on to say, particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. I've got a debt to pay. Mark gave up a lot of his time. I don't think I've finished paying it off. We all know how much Dan has given to us. I owe a lot. That man gave me his time. He gave me his time in the last couple of years of his life. I had no idea how unwell Dan was. He had cancer. Never spoke about it. I knew he had cancer. I didn't know it was terminal. Didn't tell me. Spent time talking to me. We mostly chatted online. And he gave me that time. I give people my time because I owe that. You know, they need it. There's nothing more valuable than giving someone your time and concern. So I really try and do that. Abby went on to tell Bill that faith without works is dead. I can talk about this all I like, but if I don't bring it into an action and live this way. And I've had friends recently, one of my dearest friends, relapsed. Very well educated with this work. But if we don't practice our practice, we will fall victim to whatever our illness is, you know. And I'm sure he'll come back, you know. How appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, not by sitting alone in meditation, not by focusing overly on myself. Thank you. Through work and self-sacrifice for others is how we do it. What we're doing now, giving people our time, teaching them the things that we had to learn. Okay, I grow by doing what we're doing here, right? We're teaching each other. We're helping each other. We're sharing from the heart. Sometimes it's more personal from the heart. Sometimes it's more formal and educational. But regardless, when I'm thinking of others, I'm growing outside of selfishness and self-centeredness, you know. So to finish off, he says, if I don't work and have self-sacrifice for others, I will not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. 2020 to 2021, COVID-19, who survived it? Who's still here? Who's still sober? Right? You had a program you relied on. You thought of other people. First thing I thought of, let's get a meeting online. Let's record some of this stuff. Let's be helpful to others. Because I wanted to survive. Some of my friends have drank during COVID and had a terrible experience. But it's not COVID's fault. These times were going to come. Okay. Just like the Great Depression came, world wars came, they survived and got through it. We can get through this too if we think of others. If I do not work, I will surely drink again. And if I drink, I will surely die. Right, has more grit when you say it in first person. That's how it feels to me. If I don't think of you, I'm going to think of myself. I'm going to go within myself again, and eventually I'm going to drink. Then faith would be dead indeed. And with us, it is just like that. With Steve, it is just like that. So I did that a little backwards, but I hope I shared from my heart. I got to the reading eventually, and the bright spot of my life today is working with others, you know, and you see the light come on in someone's eyes and see them realize that their life can be so much more if they think of others and work with others. It's a beautiful thing. So I'm going to leave it there. Thank you, everyone. I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you so much, Steve. That was a wonderful share. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording.